Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Allison. Welcome back. Happy New Year.
To you too.
Thanks. I know it is in the middle of the month, but you know, we are allowed to say it here in France until the end of the month.
Yeah, that's right. So we're here. And since our last show, we've, well, had the death of Jean-Marie Le Pen, the co-founder of the far-right National Front.
Yeah, he died last week at the age of 96, and there's a public mass being held for him today in Paris on Thursday.
He was sometimes known as the devil of the Republic. He spent 70 years in politics. He ran for president 5 times. He never quite made it, but he did famously get through to the second round in 2002.
And sparked a lot of protests around that. But he was an MP, an MEP, and he's had a huge influence on French politics. His big issue was immigration, and that, of course, has become far more mainstream in France. And there are also a record number of far-right MPs in France today, kind of because of his work starting this party.
Yeah, absolutely, which is now, of course, been rebranded as the National Rally.
Yeah.
Now, Le Pen was anti-Semitic. He made no secret of that. He was Islamophobic, and he was convicted several times for racist remarks.
Yeah, famously for calling the Nazi gas chambers a mere detail of history. There were a few spontaneous street parties when he died. The French government called that outrageous.
But what also raised eyebrows was some comments made by the Prime Minister, François Bayrou. He described Le Pen as a fighter and a figure of French political life beyond the, quote, polemics that were his favourite weapon. Now, a number of politicians on the left considered that, considering Le Pen was a Holocaust denier and someone who had carried out torture as a paratrooper during the war in Algeria, well, the word polemic was maybe a bit of an understatement. Now, Le Pen enlisted in the army to defend France's colonial presence in Algeria. And since Algeria got independence in 1962, France and Algeria have had a very fraught relationship. Of course, there is ongoing trauma from the bloody 8-year War of Independence.
Right, and the colonial vestiges, of course. But the two countries do have, right, a history of economic, cultural and military cooperation.
And Algerians make up France's largest foreign community now, around 2 million people. But over the last few months, a serious big freeze has set in between Paris and Algiers. Algeria was furious when in October last year, President Macron announced that he officially supported Morocco's claim to Western Sahara over that of the Algerian-backed independence movement. And then, a month later, the French-Algerian writer Boualem Sansal, who's been very critical of the Algerian regime, was arrested on national security charges when he was on a trip back to Algiers. Macron said recently that Algeria was dishonouring itself by keeping Sansal in detention.
That's heavy language, especially when you're in diplomacy speak.
Yeah. And things got even worse a couple of days after that when France tried to deport a French-Algerian blogger known as Doualem. He was accused of inciting violence on TikTok against a member of the Algerian opposition. But the authorities in Algiers refused to accept him. France was livid.
Je pense qu'on a atteint avec l'Algérie un seuil extrêmement inquiétant.
I think we've crossed an extremely worrying threshold with Algeria, said the Interior Minister Bruno Retailleau. It's obvious that Algeria is trying to humiliate France. Now, French Foreign Minister has also said there might have to be restrictions to visas or development aid in view of Algeria's position. Algeria then issued a statement denying it was involved in a logic of escalation or humiliation, and it then said that France's remarks were dishonourable.
Oh, lots of one-upmanship there. Yeah, one the other by the sounds of it, and a bit of a diplomatic nightmare.
It is. And yet it also reflects the absence of a functioning diplomacy in both countries. And this is allowing domestic politics to be played out. That's what Adlène Mohammadi told me. He's a Paris-based researcher and lecturer specialising in the Arab world. And he is himself French-Algerian. He reckons the case of the deported blogger should also be considered a domestic issue.
this issue is meant to be a French internal issue. And I mean, the idea that someone should be expelled, you know, this way before the trial that was scheduled for February. This is supposed to be an internal French issue and not a bilateral issue.
So why has France made it seemingly an issue that directly concerns Algeria?
Because I think, and this is the case for both countries, I think that the bilateral relations are polluted by internal affairs and by internal political debates. In Algeria, it's obvious, you know, you have this lack of democratic legitimacy, and the Algerian regime is using this anti-French rhetoric, actually, to try to divert, I think, from this problem, the main democratic problem.
Because President Tebboune was elected with apparently more than 94% of the vote last year in an election that was criticised as not at all fair.
Absolutely, very peculiar circumstances. And now we're having exactly the same problem in France too, because the internal French debate is polluting the bilateral relations. And this has to do with the importance taken by the far right in France. And the minister that you mentioned is
Bruno Retailleau,
yes. Mm. He is actually a far-right minister. I mean, there is no difference between his ideological positions and the Rassemblement National's position. So I think that this is also a problem.
Because the far-right National Rally, now the biggest single party in the French Parliament with 124 MPs, so clearly in a position of power. So just help us understand, why is the sort of Algeria question so important to the French far-right?
I think you have two main factors. The first one, the historic one, is, of course, the Algerian War. I mean, there is an unresolved trauma regarding the Algerian War, and this is one of the main factors that explain, actually, even the rise of the far right in France.
Because the far right were absolutely opposed to Algerian independence.
Yes, absolutely.
Saw it as a kind of treachery.
Exactly. Mm. So we had, an anti-Gaullist, actually, far right, because of the Algerian independence. And the second factor is immigration. The link between the relations with Algeria and immigration became obvious. And when they think about Algeria, they think about Algerian people in France, and they think that Algerian people in France are the main immigration problem. Hmm. And immigration is the main political problem. So this is why I think that the far right is trying to, I mean, yes, somehow to influence French foreign policy.
And so what we've seen is some French politicians, Bruno Retailleau, but also the Justice Minister, Gérald Darmanin, talking about how they're going to fight back. And one of the things on the table is this bilateral agreement of 1968, which came out of the Evian Accords that laid out independence for Algeria and which accorded sort of favourable rights, is that right, to Algerians here in France? And they're talking about trying to roll that back?
This idea that the 1968 agreement should be systematically questioned by the French politicians is a problem, because they give the impression that because of this treaty, the Algerian people in France are privileged, you know, are like spoiled brats in this country, which is certainly not the case. I mean, the problem is that in 1968, you had particular status given to the Algerian people because we needed them, because we needed cheap labor from Algeria. Mm. And the economic situation is quite different today, of course. Mm. And the other problem is that the general framework for foreigners in France is much more advantageous, actually, than this treaty. To give an example, if you are a Mexican or Tunisian or Moroccan student, you have the right to have a multi-year residence permit. Mm-hmm. Because of the 1968 treaty, Algerian foreigners can't have exactly this document. So most of the time now, this treaty is much more a problem than a privilege. And the difference between 1968 and now is obvious, you know. In 1968, we didn't have visas for Algerian people. And since the 80s, since I think 1986, now you need a visa, which became almost impossible actually to get in Algeria, a French visa. For many Algerians, not all of them, but many of them. So yes, they're selling politically this idea that the Algerian people, you know, are benefiting from the system, and it's not true.
What about President Macron's own position vis-à-vis Algeria? Because it sometimes appears quite confused. When he was a candidate in 2017, he talked about colonialism being a crime against humanity. A bit later in 2021, he said that the use of torture against Algerians during the war in Algeria was inexcusable. But then In that same year, he also questioned whether Algeria existed before 1830, before colonization. And then also, on the one hand, he's undertaken a kind of process of reconciliation over how to memorialize the Algerian War, and President Tebboune has complimented him on that. So there's been some very supportive stuff and then some very harsh stuff. How do you read Macron's own approach to Algeria?
I think it's almost impossible to read, because we fail actually to identify any consistent view in his foreign policy regarding Trump, Europe, the Middle East, Algeria, Morocco. So yeah, this is a big problem, because I mentioned earlier the main problem in Algeria, which is the lack of democratic legitimacy. And it is a problem also in the diplomatic affairs. But we have also a problem in France with this weakened diplomacy. And I think that it is weak because it is not consistent. Because, I mean, even regarding Algeria, 3 years ago, the relations with the current Algerian president were very good. The French president praised the current president. But at that time, we had in Algeria many political prisoners. So he praised the Algerian president, even though he knew that we had exactly the same problems we're having now regarding the political prisoners, for example. So, I mean, now, for the first time, because of the Boualem Sansal's case,
the French-Algerian writer,
he mentioned the problem of human rights in Algeria, but he seems to discover them. I mean, and that's a problem. And, I mean, the most dangerous thing I think I'm seeing now regarding the French-Algerian relations is, I mean, the idea that the French leaders today, for the first time, I think, seem to be tempted to sacrifice the relations with Algeria, even though we're bound to be close for many reasons, demographic reasons, geographic reasons, etc. But despite all that, he seems to be tempted, actually, for different political reasons, to sacrifice this relation. And the difference he's making between Algeria and Morocco is also problematic. I mean, he is presenting Morocco as the perfect partner, while Algeria is the worst possible partner. We know the problems with the Algerian regime. This is a problem because French Algerian people and French Algerian interests are threatened because of that. Mm.
Would you say that France and Algeria still need one another?
Yes, absolutely. Not only for economic reasons, but also for economic reasons. In 2023, for example, compared to 2022, trade relations between Algeria and France increased by, I think, 15%.
So in terms of moving forward, what can be done? Are you suggesting that we need better diplomacy or more diplomats taking hold of this instead of people like the Interior Minister and the Justice Minister and whichever minister wants to take the microphone on any given day?
Yes, exactly. I think we should try to promote diplomacy instead of political communication, because, I mean, the idea that everything, and this is a problem both France and Algeria are facing today, this big, huge political communication. And I mean, we say political communication to be polite, but it's propaganda, actually. Yeah. And this is a problem. And I think that we should get rid of this and let maybe some wise diplomats take care of this issue.
We know that funding for diplomacy, it's a big issue here in France. For diplomats, 2 years ago, they were on strike.
Absolutely.
Which was really unusual, complaining basically about how they're being watered down. So that's clearly an ongoing problem. Maybe just a little personal question to finish. Adeline, you were born in Algeria, came to France as a teenager, so you're really between those two cultures. How does it feel with this current climate?
It's a bit awkward because I'm quite comfortable with the two cultures. I mean, I'm Algerian and I'm French, and I have this double identity, and I'm lucky to have this and to be a dual national. But at the same time, of course, the situation is not really easy today, because I feel targeted at the same time by the Algerian propaganda, an Algerian regime fighting free speech and independent analysis in Algeria. And at the same time, of course, I feel always targeted by some French right-wing, let's say, not only far-right, but right-wing political speeches. I mean, the problem is you start with the foreigners, and then a year ago, I think, Bruno Retailleau clearly expressed his reservations regarding the rule of law. And he said, you know, there is a difference between democracy and the rule of law, etc. So the threat is that you start with foreigners, and then even the French nationals with some origins can be targeted too. That's the main threat today.
Mon corps est à moi, et c'est moi qui sais si je veux ou pas mettre bas. Ce n'est pas plus papa que le pape ou le roi, le juge ou le docteur ou le légiste. législateurs qui me feront la loi.
So we've talked about abortion in the show before. The right to get one in France goes back 50 years ago this week when France enacted a law decriminalizing ending a pregnancy. This was on the 17th of January, 1975. The law was first put forward by Health Minister Simone Veil, who did not identify as a feminist, but that right to abortion transformed women's health care in France and is a key victory of the feminist movement. Our colleague, Olia Horton, has been looking into this. Hello, Olia.
Hi, Sarah.
So, Olia, back in 1975, that law actually was just an experiment.
Exactly. The law was passed by lawmakers actually in 1974 in the parliament. This came after a very long and combative debate. It was initially only adopted for a period of 5 years, but then it was prolonged indefinitely in 1979. And of course, since then, over 50 years, there have been updates reflecting the changes in society. And last year, the right to abortion was enshrined in the French constitution in March.
And Olia, that was done in large part, right, as a reaction to the United States Supreme Court decision to overturn the Roe versus Wade, which protected abortion rights there and had seemed to be really, you know, the law of the land.
Indeed, before it was actually enshrined in the Constitution, these acts at any time could have been repealed by a majority of lawmakers. Interestingly, France is the EU country alongside Sweden, which has the highest abortion rate. It has been stable for the last three decades, sitting at around 220,000 per year, even as the population increased. But this figure has been rising sharply in the early 2020s, reaching 241,700 in 2023. A report by INED, which is the National Institute for Demographic Studies, suggests that the increase in elective abortions may be in response to greater social and economic insecurity and increasing uncertainty about the future.
So this is, of course, then a choice for women to manage their lives, something that's fundamental to the feminist movement. I want to go back to 1975, though. Simone Veil, as we said, was not actually a feminist.
No, she didn't particularly identify with the feminist movement, but she championed a right that was indeed a feminist cause.
Yeah, and a lot of others around her pushed it. Several years ago, I actually spoke to Sophie Hérault, who was starting practicing medicine in 1981. She was a medical student in the 1970s, so when all this was being debated and passed. And she told me that she was interested in performing abortions as part of a general interest in women's health care. And she learned how to do them, even if at the time that law was only going to be temporary.
The law in 1975 was just for a short period. And I said to myself, oh, maybe it's not going to go on. So I have to learn how to make abortions so I can help women if it's not allowed afterwards.
So you were ready to do it illegally?
Yeah. It was just voted for a few years and it was just an experiment. So I wanted to be sure it was not going only to be an experiment because the old doctors told me it was horrible how the infections and when it was not safe because it was not allowed. So I tried to be taught how to make an abortion.
Hérault eventually became a GP, but she did want to learn how to do abortions as not very many doctors wanted to do the procedure.
It was, of course, a taboo, but it's still a taboo anyway. But I was in a gynecological service at this time. It was, I don't know, in 1978 or so. And there was an intern who wanted to teach me. I really thought that it was for a GP very important to do that because it didn't interest anybody. It was a shame to do abortion. Medical doctors say, oh, you're doing abortion, huh?
So the taboo has indeed shifted slightly. It hasn't disappeared. It still exists among doctors and patients. And in fact, the group called Planning Familial, which is an advocacy group in France, found in a recent survey that 41% of women who recently had an abortion stated that they still felt that the right was taboo. 63% of them feared being judged either by family members or society at large. And 37% said they felt that pressure was exerted on women like themselves who wish to have an abortion.
So, Olia, enshrining the right in the Constitution doesn't seem to have been enough to reassure people.
Exactly. That's what Planning Familial says.
those who seek out abortions are not always able to get one right away, even though the infrastructure is in place. The survey found that 27% of the women who sought an abortion over the last 5 years had been faced with a refusal. This has something to do with the conscience clause, which was part of the original law, and it states that the medical practitioner has the right to refuse to carry out an abortion, but they must refer the patient to a service who is able to do that. Public hospitals are not allowed to refuse outright. Private clinics are not obliged to accept, but they also must offer a referral to another medical centre.
But of course, not all doctors do this, which means that access to abortion kind of depends on the doctors.
Exactly. It does remain very unequal across France. There was a Senate report that came out in October of 2024 pointing out that most abortions occur, in fact, in France's overseas departments and regions. But it was in these same departments, such as Guyana, Guadeloupe, Reunion Island, where women found it extremely difficult to access the health centres due to distances and lack of transport. Rural areas in mainland France were also subject to similar difficulties. The Senate report said that there was not enough medical staff available and also not enough medical staff willing to be trained to do abortions.
So it seems clear, Olia, that 50 years later, there's still a way to go to make sure that anyone who does want to access the right to abortion can actually do so.
C'est nous les nouveaux dinosaures. On finira au musée dans un décor. Et sur la pancarte en gros caractère. Homme en terrasse, buvant un verre, et qui attend bien patiemment la fin de son ère.
Now, Alison, I want to shift gears a bit now and talk dinosaurs.
Oh, really?
Did you know that France is full of dinosaur bones?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So except maybe in the Museum of Natural History. They've got some fantastic exhibits on show, but I didn't know they were kind of French-based.
Yeah, well, so not all of them from there are. Yeah. But yeah, there's a bunch all over France, and they keep on being discovered. In October last year, there were several parts of a skeleton of a huge sauropod found in an excavation in Charente in western France. Famous sauropods are Apatosaurus or Diplodocus.
Diplodocus.
Yeah, you're up on your dinosaurs there. There were other finds in northern France at the start of last year. France, it turns out, has a lot of dinosaur bones in its rocks.
We have very old dinosaurs, and some are more than 200 million years old, and we have some of the very last dinosaurs that lived just before the extinction, and many in between. And also it means a big diversity of dinosaurs, including very, very big things.
Eric Buffetot is a paleontologist. He's had a long career working on dinosaurs in France.
I have colleagues in the Paris Museum who've been digging in western France for some years now. I found bones, leg bones that are more than 2 meters in length, really huge herbivorous dinosaurs, sauropods, that lived at the beginning of the Cretaceous. But also we have quite small dinosaurs. There is one very nice skeleton that was found in Provence something like 40 years ago now. It's about the size of a turkey. And we also have even smaller things. And all kinds also, from carnivorous to herbivorous. We have armored dinosaurs. We have really a great diversity of dinosaurs that spread over a long time period.
So this has to do with France's geology. Dinosaurs lived between about 230 million years ago and 66 million years ago. France today has rocks from all of those periods, and some of them have dinosaur bones. A key period here is the Jurassic, from about 200 to 140 million years ago. And that period is actually named after the Jura Mountains in eastern France. On the border with Switzerland, Jura, Jurassic. There, limestone from that period was first identified.
That's a place in France where quite a few dinosaur remains have been found, especially in rather recent years, lots of dinosaur footprints, including those of very, very large dinosaurs. One of those trackways at that place called Pragne in the Jura Mountains is really spectacular because the footprints are very large and also it goes on for, I don't know, something like 200 meters. It's quite a long trackway.
Obviously, paleontology goes back for a long time, even in France, but you get the impression that some, when you start reading, you know, dinosaur discoveries, a lot of them are fairly recent, say, even in the 21st century.
Well, actually, some of the first dinosaurs that were ever found were found in France back in the late 18th century, when Georges Cuvier, who was the leading paleontologist at the time, described some bones from Normandy, which he thought were peculiar crocodiles, but in fact, they turned out to be dinosaurs, in fact. But after that, there was a long period when French paleontologists apparently were not so interested in dinosaurs. They were interested in other things like fossil mammals or human evolution. And then there was really a renewal of interest in the, I would say, at the end of the 20th century. A few paleontologists in France said, well, we have dinosaurs in France, so why don't we look at them in more detail? They've been there all the time, but nobody cared very much.
So this is including you among these people?
Well, yes, that's right, partly. And since I would say 1980s, more or less, more and more people have become interested in French dinosaurs, and consequently more discoveries have been made.
So when you started out as a paleontologist, were people, you know, looking at you like, why are you interested in these things and not others? Like, was it a strange thing to be doing?
It wasn't a big fashion when I was a student. Most paleontology students wanted to work on fossil humans, especially, and that kind of things. Not so many were interested in dinosaurs. I was one of the few. But the fact that more and more dinosaur remains were found in France, of course, led more paleontologists to become involved. I conducted the excavations in southern France for many years, and we found quite a few dinosaur remains from late Cretaceous deposits, but also have been involved in studies on dinosaurs from other parts of France, especially Normandy, where I'm from, which is the place where the dinosaurs were first found in France, and they keep being found. But interestingly, they're found not so much by professional paleontologists, but by non-professional people who are just interested in fossil collectors.
Like, what happens? You get a call and someone says, hey, yes, we just found something interesting in the cliffs? Like,
basically that. The question is to get a good network of amateur paleontologists who can you can trust them, and you know that if they find something interesting, they will contact you. And this is what happened not so long ago when someone in the cliffs between Le Havre and Etretat found dinosaur bones. This man is by name of Nicolas Cotard. He's been collecting fossils since he was a kid, actually. And he's done a lot of work, very serious work on the fossils from the Choke Cliffs along the English Channel in Normandy. And 4 years ago, he found the first big block of rock containing bones. With a friend, they started preparing the fossil, taking it out of the rock. They knew they had something interesting. So they contacted me and asked me, what do you think? And I said, it's difficult to say what it is. And then 2 years later, he found the second block that fitted the first. They fit together. And the new block was interesting because there was a tooth in it also. And the tooth was very, very clearly that of a big carnivorous dinosaur. So I spent quite a long time making comparisons and discussing it with colleagues in other countries as well. And it turned out to be something that you would expect to find in South America, not on the Normandy coast.
What did you name it, or what was its name?
We named it Carreto Draco. The Carretai were a Celtic tribe that lived in that part of Normandy in antiquity. So Draco means a dragon, so it's a dragon of the Carretai. And the species name is after the discoverer. It's called Cotard, because Nicolas Cotard found it. It's something that couldn't have been found if these local collectors hadn't been there, because professional paleontologists cannot be in the field all the time, everywhere in a country like France. So you must rely on the cooperation of such people who are able to go to collect fossils in the cliffs along the sea every weekend. So they keep a really constant watch of what's coming out of the cliffs.
And so what happens then? Where do these dinosaurs end up?
Under French rule, the owner of a fossil is the owner of the land where it is found. In that particular case, there's the cliffs on the seaside, which belong to the state. But in that particular case, it's considered that the finder can keep it. But he didn't keep it. He decided to donate it to the Natural History Museum in Le Havre, where it is now, in a public institution, which is the best thing that could happen to it, actually. Some people who find fossils are a bit reluctant to part with them, of course, and I can understand that, but it can be a problem after that when you want to describe them in a scientific paper, and you have to know that they will be kept somewhere and will not disappear somewhere.
And so you brought with you today a cast of a bone. So tell me what this is.
It's the end of a femur of a dinosaur, carnivorous dinosaur. It's a cast or a replica. The original is in the Paris Museum. It was found, it's not quite clear when or by whom it was found, but it very probably comes from the Vachnoir cliffs on the Normandy coast, where quite a few remains of Jurassic dinosaurs have been found. So it's one of those big meat-eating Jurassic dinosaurs that you find in the Jurassic rocks of France and also other European countries. It was collected by someone in the 19th century, because it's mentioned in 19th century papers and books. By comparison with other birds, bones and also the rock around them from Normandy. We can be pretty sure it comes from those cliffs. But we have very few details about who found it, exactly when. So it's a bit of a mystery, really.
Going back to the world of paleontology, how many paleontologists actively working on French dinosaurs would you say there are today? Like today?
Not so many, actually. It's probably less than 10 at most, really. Because the main problem in France is that there are no jobs for paleontologists. Many students who are really good and really enthusiastic end up doing something else because they can't find a position. My best student, who did a PhD in Nîmes nearly 10 years ago, now she couldn't find a position. Now she does something completely different, which has nothing to do with paleontology. It's really a disaster because she was really very, very, very good.
Is this a worldwide phenomenon? People are more interested in more sort of snazzy sciences, or does particularly in France it's less interested?
I mean, the situation is not very good in most European countries, even though France is especially bad. Probably the best country now in the world if you want to do paleontology is China, because the Chinese government has decided that paleontology was really an important science. The result is that young Chinese paleontologists find positions easily, really. While in France, paleontology is not considered really something important. It's something nice, but why spend money on that? It has no economic importance. So the contrast couldn't be greater between the Chinese official position and that of French authorities.
Throughout your career, this has always been the case, or have there been ups and downs?
The situation in France has been growing worse. When I first got my position in paleontology, I considered that it was really hard to find a job. It was easy by comparison with what it is now, and I realize it today, but things have been getting worse for years now. Research is really underfunded in France, especially as far as positions are concerned, and I don't see any sign that it is improving at the moment, really. So there's a lot of interest in dinosaurs. I keep getting emails from students who ask me if they could, can I take them on a dinosaur excavation and so on. What I try to tell them is, if you're really interested, not only in dinosaurs, in paleontology in general, well, you should try, but you should know it will be very, very difficult, and there is absolutely no guarantee that you will ever get a job. So be warned. I'm trying not to be discouraging, but at the same time, people should know what to expect.
So we're at a kind of low point in French paleontology, but discoveries continue to happen.
Well, the fossils are still there. And the fact that new interesting discoveries are made all the time show that even though the job situation and funding situation are really, really bad in France at the moment, there's still sufficient interest for fossils to be found and excavated and described. So there's still hope. What's important, I think, is that amateur paleontologists should be encouraged to go on. Without those people, many, many important fossils would go undiscovered, would remain undiscovered.
So it's good to discover undiscovered fossils. But I have to say, Sarah, that, you know, the lack of funding for dinosaur research does seem maybe like a bit of a low priority on the list in France, given that it has these huge problems with the budget. It's got to make 60 billion in savings.
It's true. But this lack of support really does go back even before the current budget crisis. It really is actually a broader issue of the funding of fundamental scientific research that's being cut across the board. I mean, this is research that looks at the world around us, you know, looks at our bodies, looks under the ocean, looks at bones, looks at geology. This is the idea of trying to understand how things are and how things were, but without any guaranteed financial payout at the end.
Regarde. Tu n'as pas l'air d'un dinosaure.
So that's it for Spotlight on France. We're a production of Radio France International.
This episode was mixed by Cécile Pompeani. Thanks to Anne-Marie of the Geppetto and Vélo Bike Shop in Paris for recording assistance.
And if you want to send us a message, please do. You can write to us at spotlight.france@rfi.fr. We're also on Instagram at Spotlight on France.
We'll be back with a new show on Thursday, January 30th. Bye, Alison.
Bye-bye, Sarah.
Espèce ancienne, mais a du sang dans nos veines, qui commence à bouillir, un peu trop tard pour voir venir. Aspire.